project book I have. At the time, you had about 13,000 students. What was it that attracted you to Southern Illinois?
Forgive me, I don't understand. 13,000 students, where? Only you
could have been right.
I had recalled.
All right.
All right.
Okay. Well, anyway, what attracted you to Southern Illinois?
Well, number one, pay. I mean, I would be not telling the truth. And opportunity was matched by the pay, because it was a university that had a dynamic leadership under the ex-president Morris, who was bringing students essentially from the greater Chicago area. And money from the state of Illinois was always combined with a number of heads. I wouldn't call it students, because some of the students were substandard. They just came and partied and never graduated. But the opportunity was definitely there.
In other words, a much, much higher prestige at a university than at
only that, it was a well-recognized curriculum. Because I remember when I was at Marshall, we had a consultant from Southern Illinois University who was talking about the program of general studies, because we had so many unqualified university students at Marshall. It behooved the Marshall administration to see what a general studies program would do for the Marshall curriculum. And interestingly, this had national recognition, this program here. When I came to Illinois SIU, it was in existence, but it was already under scrutiny. When within 10 years, this model of general studies was boarded out, because it was survey-oriented studies, and it did not bring the necessary results. It did not elevate the deficient students sufficiently high.
And you went there as what, department chairman?
Yes, I came there as department chairman, and I don't know if I told you how I came there.
No.
Well, when I was at Marshall, we were building a department very successfully. We were a very coherent department, and the anchor in the new faculty was Ned Heindel. At the time I left, Ned was already gone, to be sure. But during that five-year period, I interviewed, or the department interviewed, a fellow named Donald Slocum. Donald Slocum was I remember, Duke graduate. We made him an offer, which he didn't accept, because he had two offers to consider, one of ours and the other one from Southern Illinois University. Well, he has been there about 2 years when the then chairman of the department, Neckers, who has been the chairman I believe 30 years, was finally retiring, and left the chairmanship open, and I was invited to be his successor. A big shoe to fill, to be sure. A man who has been there from the normal university age, did all the hiring, did run a very tight ship. But retirement came. Neckers, I met him before I went on this particular tour. He's 97 years old, and he's as spry as when he retired in 1967.
Oh, great.
we occupy a building named after him, which is not so common, because buildings are named after people who are no longer with us, but he's outlived everybody. But it was not unusual, because our president, Morris, also built a modern 7-story high library and named him after himself.
Okay. Well, you're talking about naming buildings. So many times they're named after people who give a lot of money.
Well, yes.
Living or dead.
Morris was very, very successful. He was a very close friend from Southern Illinois, who was Secretary of State, and the automobile license had to be paid for by checks made out personally to to the Secretary of State. When he died, he left a lot of money in shoeboxes. So he was a faithful contributor to Southern Illinois.
Oh, shoebox
shoebox too.
I want to digress just a moment. You mentioned Ned kind of a while ago, and I meant to ask you the other day, just a comment really. Sir Humphrey Davy once said that Michael Faraday was his greatest discovery. I just wondered if you felt the same way about Ned.
Oh, unquestionably. I mean, first as a scholar, and just as much a gentleman and a scholar, and research productive, excellent dynamic teacher. I've never met anybody like him before or since.
I don't think I have either, as far as that goes. Back to the formal topic. What subjects did you teach? Anything besides organic chemistry, or?
No, I was truly a department chairman who wanted to teach as many subjects I was able.
Okay.
I mean, educationally able. So I taught not only organic chemistry, but I also taught a general freshman course in chemistry, and I taught a special course for non-science majors, because I try to motivate their students more than anything else.
I have heard people say that that teaching freshmen, for example, freshman chemistry, did a tremendous amount to keep them on their toes. In other words, not so much. I guess it was the whole idea of trying to get stuff down to the level, or speak to the level that they could understand. I don't know why people have said that, but I've heard more than one.
Well, it is a challenge to read the mind of a non-major, because I consider this to be an citizen's duty to be well aware of problems which have a chemistry basis. And I must confess, I did not succeed very much. But there's one additional course that I taught in my later years, was history of chemistry.
Yeah.
For as a non-chemistry major subject, it was an elective.
The students that took it, sort of, did they really take it because they wanted to, or did they think it was a crib course, an easy course?
I mean, you're talking
the
about
history of chemistry.
Both, I think. I mean, some really wanted, some came from related department to hear it, faculty as well as spouses of ones. So obviously there was a demand and a need. I don't doubt it. Many students took it because it was not a required course, and they wanted to fill the graduation requirement in the number of credit hours this generated.
I can't remember whether I asked you this the other day before, but how many graduate students overall did you have while you were at SIU?
Mean that I did. No, over the years.
Yes.
Over the years, about 20, thereabouts. Some masters and advanced PhD students. most of the students were there during the Pittsburgh era.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess you had enough administrative duties, at least
later on.
You didn't have time for it. What kind of research were you into? I mean, was this a continuation of what you had done before at Pittsburgh?
Well, I mentioned earlier that my basic work was synthesis of acetylene, and at the end of this research, I succeeded in making the beta acetylenic acid by a method that escaped me while I was, before I was writing the dissertation. That was a cyclic reactor which produced not only the desired acid but also an alenic acid. This material was not to be found in my dissertation because my dissertation was already finished and died. And the first thing that I did when I was on my own is to repeat that experiment, see if it was not a fluke, and then were able to reproduce it and extend the synthesis to other type of compounds. Alenes became my major subject. I must also regress here because Aline was so much on my mind, and there were some bets about my graduate student if I wanted to name my coming daughter Aline, which I did. Spelled according to Geneva system in nomenclature.
I don't know whether you would like to take these slides that you've used before and just talk through some of these things. I had mentioned the other day that about doing the work on the discovery of the calcium carbide acetylene process or working on the history of that, and so I was just fascinated with it that you had worked on acetylene compounds when we first met or somewhere along the line. I learned about that, and also we had talked a little bit about the fact that there was such an explosion seemingly in the 40s on acetylene chemistry, and I guess you were just part of that whole scene of renewed interest in acetylene chemistry.
The project that was suggested to me originated before World War II by Newman, who already was well familiar with a lack of information in the literature, namely a synthesis of compound of the same general structure but differing only by the position of a triple bond in relationship to a different functional group, and that was a preparation of all the isomeric octanoic acid. Maybe it was a coincidence, maybe it was design. I don't know what was in Newman's mind when he suggested this particular doctoral dissertation research.
You want to explain any of those charts? And I think when we do this, we can probably append some of these to the whole oral history.
Well, I have in front of me an table that lists all the isomeric octanoic acid. No branching, only difference position of the triple bond in relation to the carboxy group. I don't know what I said before, but it merits certain repetition. The beta acetylenic acid, which looked on paper the easiest one to make, turned out to be the hardest one. the beta acetylenic acid I started before I went to the service, and I finished it at last, just before I was ready to throw in the towel. I made it by a roundabout way that on paper looks ridiculous, but that's what turned out to be necessary. But the beta acetylenic acid was eventually prepared by carbonation of a Grignard reagent derived from halide. And the carbonation, the problem was the Grignard reagent from the bromide and that reactive propargylic bromide did some coupling and could not be carbonated because it was no longer in existence. It already reacted with the addition of the new starting material. And when I was conducting the visitors through the Ohio State Laboratories, I discovered that one of my friends and colleagues in the API building developed a way how to make a Grignard reagent from a propargylic halide without using excessive volume of ether to prevent coupling. You really need infinite dilution. And did I explain the operation?
You did explain the operation of that column.
Yeah. The cyclic reactor.
But we lost that. So
okay.
So if you can go through that again, I think that was fascinating.
Let me turn to a diagram. I'm referring to the operation. What was later on known as a cyclic reactor. It consists of a boiler where ether was vaporized. The vapors were condensed and the liquid ether flowed by gravity over a column filled with magnesium. It was about 20 centimeters.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, it wasn't. It's been a long time.
Something. Now, into a stream of refluxing ether, we added the reactive halide, which sat on top of the condenser. The allylic halide, which was used by API, the propargylic halide used in my research. Incidentally, the device was fitted with what is known as a Newman stopcock.
I noticed that was unusual.
Because it lets you count the drops that you put there. So the halide was diluted with ether. Was put through the Newman stopcock and was flowing by gravity over the magnesium turnings. It's one thing that should be said. The magnesium turnings had a coating of mercury because before you filled it, it was standing for some time with mercury chloride, and the shiny surface of magnesium turned gray. Greenley never investigated. I did not investigate. This was perhaps empirical, but it worked. As the reaction started at the height of the magnesium packed in a column, you could see that the grayish coated magnesium was reacting and it became shiny again. So something must have been going on, and the ether actually started boiling because the exothermic reaction between the halide and the ether, which was filling the column. And of course, magnesium was consumed at the top of the packing. That was a sidearm here, because we had to add more magnesium, because we never let it go below the half point, because if we exhaust the half of it, we run the chance that some may go through into the boiler. Now, a formed green heart reagent, which had no chance to do any coupling, because as soon as it was formed, it was being pushed through the column by the addition of ether. So products, the propargylate green heart reagent, didn't have a chance to react with the original starting material. It was accumulating in the flask where the beta ether was vaporized all over again.
And how did you know when the ether would become saturated with it?
That was never established precisely. Like all good chemists, you develop a feel. But when the halide was exhausted and the column washed through with more ether, it was accumulating, and it was a clear ether solution. It was then subsequently poured onto dry ice to do the carbonation. The carbonation step in its own right became quite important, because as we have established several years later, the green heart reagent produced two products, alenic and acetylene, and a third product, which was a dimeric acid, a product of reaction of the green heart reagent with a formed green heart reagent. And if you did it slowly, you got more of a dimeric product. If you put it on dry ice quickly, you decrease the byproduct.
Good chemistry. Anything else in there that you want to cover?
In the addendum?
Yes.
Well, you wanted to talk about the preparation of starting material?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Well, I like you have to keep this off over the top of the mic.
Now, the starting material for my sequence of reaction, or the one that I use as example, was one hexane, a triple bar on the end of the chain. The acidic, the hydrogen on a carbon number one is acidic, but not as acidic as water or ammonium. It is more acidic than a hydrogen in a green heart reagent. Therefore, an acid displaces a weaker acid in a reaction with other green heart reagent, which, when formed, can be condensed with formaldehyde to yield the propargylic alcohol. Alcohol converted by standard method into the halide. Originally, I had to make a cyanide, a hydrolyzed cyanide with hydrochloric acid in methanol to give the ester of the desired product. And of course, once you form the green heart reagent, you could have gone directly to the acid by carbonation. And originally, this was not possible because we did not isolate the green heart reagent, this particular green heart reagent, with lack of the high dilution problem, which subsequent technique eliminated.
Anything else in there?
Well, one problem led to another problem. Here I'm illustrating the coupling reaction. reaction was a major reaction during the attempt of making a proper gelic greenhouse reaction. But a problem that we did not anticipate had a rather interesting origin. In the carbonation of the propargelic Ringhardt reagent, we got two products, acetylenic and alenic, I think I mentioned earlier. This was an example of a rearranged product. The rearrangement was eventually referred to as an acetylene-alene rearrangement. I call it a propargelic rearrangement, which duplicated the terminology in the allylic rearrangement. An allyl halide is to be compared with a propargyl halide, so far as the position of the double bond in allylic and triple bond in a propargylic structure vis-a-vis the position of the halide. Well, I was somewhat surprised when I gave a lecture on our rearrangement that abroad in Europe they referred to this rearrangement as a Wodis rearrangement.
That came as a surprise to you?
Well, it came as a surprise because you don't name a reaction after yourself. The acid-alene rearrangement is more descriptive. Organic chemists are very familiar with the allylic rearrangement. Young from California studied the allylic rearrangement extensively in the 30s. The most product of the 30s would call it or named it propargelic rearrangement.
I have a book somewhere at home that has just brief descriptions of all the named organic reactions. I'll have to check it and see what's in there. Or propargelic.
Propargelic. Because I named my series of publications afterwards. They were named propargelic, the chemistry of propargelic rearrangement, and there were several papers in the series. But I never called it the word is rearrangement. I mentioned earlier that so-called dimeric acid resulted by a secondary reaction of reacting unreacted. That's a very descriptive. But anyway, they formed the Grignard reagent reacting with a reaction product, the carboxylic acid, adding across a double bond. This is very, very unusual that a Grignard reagent adds across a double bond, olefinic double bond, which in this particular case is a double bond of an allene, which is a cumulative diene. And the product was a highly sterically hindered carboxylic acid, where one of the carboxyl groups is not detectable by simple titration. It had twice the molecular weight, but titrated as a monobasic acid. This led to a sequence of publication, how to prepare highly substituted malonic acid, because the two carboxyl groups that were formed were attached to the same carbon atom. Therefore, a malonic acid derivative. And this in itself led to other types of reaction and comparison that I don't think we are covering right now. The other surprising thing was a preparation of the starting material. I mentioned earlier our starting material was hexane. Well, hexane actually was made from acetylene itself by alkylation of one hydrogen in the attached carbon in acetylene. This technique was realized in liquid ammonia. Not many people at that time would take ammonia as a solvent, but it's an ideal solvent if you know how to contain the low boiling point of ammonia. All what you need is a condenser filled with a cooling material that a slurry of dry ice and acetone provides. And you tap the gas in liquid form under pressure from a starting cylinder or contained in a cylinder. You put it in a regular kind of a reaction vessel. You insulate it so that the surrounding warm air doesn't force the ammonia boil very vigorously. Well, into the solution of ammonia, you add sodium metal, which converts into sodium amide, and hydrogen is evolved. Reacting this additional amount of acetylene, the sodium amide forms eventually the sodium salt of acetylene. Being an organometallic compound, it couples with an alkyl halide, in this particular case butyl bromide, and upon working up the product, you get hexane. Now, the hexane was the starting material, but in our example, it was formed by the reaction of butyl bromide with sodium acetylide to form hexane. The next step was the formation of alcohol by converting it to a Grignard reagent, which is then alkylated to form butyl magnesium halide, butyl acetylenic magnesium halide. Well, in the original one, we converted it by the use of ethyl magnesium bromide, which then was reacted with formaldehyde to form the acetylenic alcohol. In this reaction, ethyl magnesium bromide is converted into ethane, which escapes. It's done in ether at room temperature. We used ethyl bromide to form the ethyl magnesium reagent because, again, of convenience. Ethyl bromide is liquid at room temperature. I must tell you a story behind the story.
Okay.
At that time I was at the University of Pittsburgh, and even then, it was the heyday of financial contribution. We had a very stingy custodian of chemicals and glassware but anyways, making a long story short, I used, as in my other research or usage, I had our custodian purchase me a cylinder of methyl bromide. I used part of it, and the cylinder, the tank of methyl bromide, was sitting in my laboratory. I had no additional usage of him, but the custodian of properties at the University of Pittsburgh, Frank Easley, I remember the name, Frank Easley, came to me one day and says, when I'm going to use up the remaining methyl bromide in the cylinder so that he can return the cylinder. He was paying demurrage, which is still, I guess, customary. And I said, well, I have no immediate use, but I was stingy enough to not to let him return the cylinder which contained, which was half filled with methyl bromide. So he essentially forced me into a reaction that I had not intended to do. I said, well, in our research we need a Grignard reagent from hexane, which I can form either by reacting reacting the acetylene with ethyl magnesium bromide. Why don't I use methyl magnesium bromide? And that was done, and the student who did it reported to me that this reaction was done during one day, one night, and the following day before it ceased in the evolution of the hydrocarbon. That surprised me because ethyl magnesium bromide reacts with acetylene compound instantaneously. Well, this was an inexperienced student, but I put it in my mind and said, well, that needs verification. The verification came also by serendipity. I had a new student that came to my attention through the friendships that my former student, who was a graduate of the School of Pharmacy, University of Pittsburgh, had with a follow-up a year later. I was sitting in my office and body has a plump, flabby body of a student was sitting waiting for me to shop in the morning. And he introduced himself as Raymond Dessy. I said, and he said, I want to do research with you. And I said, you're a new student, you're telling me, and you haven't taken any graduate courses. What do you have in mind? You're going to do research with me. I'm going to do research with you right now. And I said, well, now, wait a minute. Why right now? We don't teach any courses during summertime. Because I have a pre-doctoral NSF fellowship. Now I perked up because students that come with NSF money even before they earn any graduate credit were a rarity. It then probably is as rare today. I said, now wait a minute, let me see what I can do. And I mentioned the fact that I will be teaching a course in organic synthesis in a fall semester at that time. But the organic synthesis involved of a series of six techniques that should be useful to any graduate student. And I'll be glad to teach this on a consulting basis. He would do the six syntheses during summertime. He would register in a fall semester and get credit for it. No problem. Well, Ray Dessy turned out to be my best of my graduate student in the entire life as a researcher in university oil industry.
What happened to him? Where did he,
Well, after he finished, he wanted degree in organic, synthetic organic chemistry. And I said, well, what he eventually has done was physical organic chemistry. So I said, well, if you, no matter what we assign to you, sentence, you never got to a problem because they got sidetracked completely and established a new field. So I recommended that he takes a postdoctoral fellowship with Professor Newman, who was truly a synthetic organic. He finished that, but then he accepted a teaching position at the University of Cincinnati, changed later on to positions for professor at VPI, Virginia Polytechnic Institute in Blacksburg, Virginia. He is completely removed from organic chemistry now. He himself,
he's still there, though. He's still at the...
Well, so far as I know, lastly, he was still there, but he's definitely retirement age. Okay. And furthermore, he lost a lot of weight. He's a very trim one. I had to comment on his appearance. But anyway, it's completely changed. Hardly recognizable. But, well... let me finish that story.
Yeah, I got you off on the side track.
Right. Well, when he breezed through the six assigned syntheses, there was some time left, and I said, one of your predecessors found out the reaction between hexane and ethyl magnesium bromide is much slower, it's much faster than reacting it with methyl magnesium bromide. Would you mind repeating it? Which he did in an old time, yes, it's much slower. So it essentially validated the statement of a previous. So, and I said, well, how much slower? Let's find that out. Let's measure the rate of evolution of the gas, which next day he had all the equipment ready to go. And we eventually found that it is 15 times slower than ethyl magnesium bromide. That was a surprise. Well, how about other halides? How much faster or slower are they reacting vis-a-vis our standard of reference, which turned out to be hexane and a Grignard reagent liberating the corresponding hydrocarbon in the Grignard reagent. Well, this is a big chunk of our research. It's a kinetic, it's not only the preparative one, but the mechanism of reaction was of great interest. Now, talking about one type of chemistry leading to another one, we found this to be an beautiful medium or technique to say something about the constitution of the Grignard reagent. When Victor Grignard proposed the structure of RMG, magnesium X halogen, there was some doubt about the correct representation. This was a subject of controversy that was resolved by a proposition of two German chemists, Schlenk and Schlenk, who were representing a Grignard reagent by noting a dissociation of RMGX into R2MG and the magnesium halide MgX2. So if there is such a dissociation, can we make a Grignard reagent, a typical Grignard reagent, the opposite way by adding MgX2 to R2Mg? This we have done, and the reaction product, whatever it was, reacted by the same rate as before with hexane, absolutely identical. Then the question is how should we represent? There are different sources of magnesium the way we did. Well, we text one of magnesium, the one is magnesium halide, by irradiating con mercury, magnesium, have it attached, put it into this dissociation, and upon a reaction and with dioxane, which precipitated, we found the precipitate containing 50% of zetaic magnesium in one product and the 50% in the other product. So essentially validating the old Schlenk equilibrium. But how were we possible to do it? Because we found that the reaction between a Grignard reagent in ether with a hexane, one hexane, is homogeneous. We were not plagued with problem of dispersing. It was homogeneous, it was in a liquid form, in solution, and that was a fortuitous state of affair, which we explored rather well.
You mentioned about using liquid ammonia
yes.
as a solvent. Was this a, I don't know what's the right word for this, but a precursor to what seems to be a growing field now of so-called critical fluids, where they're using liquid carbon dioxide as a extracting agent or a solvent?
It was not a critical fluid. It was ammonia under pressure, originally supplied under pressure, that was permitted to gasify and liquefy, and sodium, when it reacted, formed first a disodium salt, because there are two acetylene hydrogen, and by addition of further amounts of acetylene, that will react to form the monosodium salt. But the disodium salt